I'm Michelle Hoover. I represent the Massachusetts Center for the Book that is sponsoring this event. What is Massachusetts Center for the Book? We promote cultural programming to support books and reading and to enhance what our libraries are doing in their outreach. We also have a number of literacy programs. We're part of the Route 1 Reads. And they've hired me this year to take on our 20th anniversary Massachusetts Book Awards. So I'm very excited about that. And I'm also very excited, because I'm a fiction writer as well, so to be able to hear from these wonderful writers on this panel. So thank you, Nikia, for moderating the panel. And let's get to it.
Amazing. Good afternoon, everyone. We have two empty seats in the front, so if anyone wants to move, especially if you have questions, that would be wonderful. Great, so let's get started. Are you ready to hear some wonderful stories today? Great, so again, my name is Nakia Hill. This is very special for me today because I actually grew up in Madison Park, so it's just a great moment for me to be here back in my neighborhood. With wonderful writers. So what we're going to do is start off with a reading by Shaya Bhushaneshwar. Take it away when you're ready.
Thank you so much for coming on a Sunday and sharing some of your weekend with us, particularly since it's a beautiful weekend. I'm going to be reading the title story of my debut story collection, White Dancing Elephants, finalist for the Penn Bingham Debut Fiction Award. And this is sort of an auto-fictional story. It's called White Dancing Elephants. I walk out to the lobby, wanting to prolong my dream of you, thinking that I'll gain some control by staying awake. Impossible. I'm too aware that people are staring at me. The lobby is tiny, compact, but cool as glass. I walk with my hands loose, hair disheveled, my pajamas covered by a trench coat. Someone glides out from behind a front desk and presses an umbrella on me because it's pouring. The rain is tropical. It's June in central London, financial district, the back of Deutsche Bank, the first building I walk past, with its gargoyles and angelic flourishes so unlike its super efficient front facade. I'm half a block away from the hotel when, shivering, I open the umbrella. The rain makes it possible to wipe my face and have people think that I was caught in a downpour. I hate metaphors of rain, fecundity, gushing water from a hidden space. There wasn't anything macabre in your passing, no rush of blood, no horrifying trickle down my legs, just two clear stains. Understated, as quiet and undemanding as your whole life had been, only enough blood for me to know. When I was younger, in my early 20s, and couldn't imagine having a child, I would stare at myself as I jogged past office buildings, appreciating the slim reflection and promising myself I'd stay that way. Now I don't look. The curve of my belly is meaningless, indulgence, no longer where I'm carrying you. But all the signs are still there of your presence, superfluous. The fuller breasts, not tender anymore, the young skin, the shiny hair that were all gifts from you. You all right then, love? A cabbie leans out his window when I stop for the light and he sees my tearful face. I nod, then make an unintended turn and keep on walking. Without realizing it, I've reached a subterranean sort of Euro mall. Octagon Arcade, it's called, though looking at the glossy bus shelter type of walls gives me too much of a headache to bother counting to see if they're really eight. Things are never named reliably. Boots is not a shop where shoes are sold in the UK. Monsoon has nothing to do with India. W.H. Smith isn't a person, but generic chain of newsstands selling cheap sandwiches and tabloid rags and things called health foods like Tiger Balm, which isn't made from tigers at all. If we were only in the forest together, we wouldn't sleep, my love. We would stay up. You would nestle against my breast, picking it up and stroking it and arranging it under your ear like a pillow, and eventually you would say, Mama, though not right away. Before you could speak, you would make sounds, and because the sounds would tell me you were listening, I would kiss your head and tell you stories, stories within stories, stories of elephants in the forest, stories of tigers. Go down the steps into the mall, heading into the pharmacy. I need pads. The first day, the way I mopped up blood was cautious, hopeful, as if by showing that it could quickly be absorbed, I was collecting proof that you were still alive. After that, I stopped measuring. Only one moment caught me unawares, like getting soaked by rain. The moment that, smiling, thinking of something else from long ago, I actually saw you on a pad. Your flesh was hard, less darkly bloody than the rest of it, more than just a part of me. Your hardness froze my smile. You had existed, formed. I could see light outlines, the shape of limbs. You were hard enough to have formed bone if you had lived more than an inch. The English pharmacy is impossibly friendly and bright. "You all right then, miss?" inquires a security guard. I look away from him, my attention fixed on the bellies of women gathering into a line. The line of them divides between the self-pay registers and the one or two cashiers who stand, bored, only as polite as required. The women's bellies divide into flat, obese, and then the one in front of me, a petite woman with long, dark hair, pregnant, I recognize, maybe even in the final trimester. She looks perfect. I turn away from her and find the one who is obese. Maybe she's never been pregnant, I think, and she's just fat, until the woman's three children follow in her wake, sullen and palely beautiful, the way dark-haired English children are, their lips a thin and natural red, their eyes pale blue. The woman's probably my age, I realize suddenly, early 40s, but she has not spent her life on mistakes. My eyes can't leave her, or her three growing daughters. The same security guard who talked to me just before comes up and gently accosts me. "You know what you're looking for? Do you need a basket or something?" he says, and I nod my head, yes, letting him put a shopping basket in my hand, even though, my darling, I have accepted nothing. You could be alive. The hard thing could have been from inside of me, a piece of a fibroid, a tumor from inside a uterus that my body was smart enough to just get rid of to make more room for you. The ultrasound could have been blocked by bowel, air, artifact, ignorance, an act of God. Maybe they didn't see you because you weren't meant to be seen. How much more clearly I would see it all if I could only rest under a tree with you kicking me awake in my belly. I'll end there. Thank you.
If you want to, it's your choice.
Ordinary calls conducted in an ordinary tone of voice, no different if you left aside the subject matter from all the other daily calls they'd made during their 7 years together. Now, though,
when he said I love you,
well, is it off?
You put the time.
Is it supposed to be on?
Yes.
I'm so sorry. Now, though, when he said I love you, she didn't want to say it back. She said it, of course. She watched the words balloon from her mouth, rubbery and hollow, and her heart shrank. There were times, alone at night in their bed, for example, when she had the feelings she was supposed to have, grief, love, longing. But the instant she opened the door to his hospital room, all of that vanished. He looked terrible with his bald head and sunken chest, his gray, unhealthy skin. Even his beautiful eyelashes were gone, even his smell, which she had loved. She had an irritable urge to rush into the room and scold. Exercise, brush your teeth, get a wig for Christ's sake. Instead, she sat down beside him and talked with him reasonably, even sweetly, until it was time to go home. It was awful. Every word, every gesture of affection seemed like a betrayal. She was acting what she used to feel. One day, while she was idling away the time at work, she learned that a friend of theirs, a man 10 years older than they, had qualified for the marathon.
The news had nothing to do with her, really. He wasn't a close friend. And yet she found herself recalling it again and again over the course of the day. The thought of this man, with his firm, lean torso and clear eyes, gave her a feeling of comfort, even elation, as though she had unexpectedly had a stroke of good luck. When she got to the hospital that afternoon, she mentioned the news to her husband. He snorted. "So? What's so great about that?" "What do you mean, what's so great? It's something like 26 miles. He raised the muscles where his eyebrows used to be. 26 miles? 26 miles is nothing. Anyone could do that. Anger swept up in her, sudden and fierce. "Oh, really, anyone?" she snapped. "Like you? You could just go out and run a marathon?" She froze. It was the wrong thing to say. "And why not, may I ask?" His eyes had their old mischievous glint. "A joke." She made herself relax back in her chair. "Because," she said in a lighter tone, "you were too," she searched for something innocuous, "prone. You were just too darn prone." "Prone?" he said. "You think I'm prone? We'll see about that." He threw off the sheet and got unsteadily to his feet. "What are you doing?" He held his hand out to silence her. Slowly, with the exaggerated gestures of a performer, he rolled the sleeves of his hospital gown up over his skinny biceps. Then he lunged forward and bowed his arms like a bodybuilder. "Who's the man?" he said. "Who's the man?" He turned around to show his back, bouncing and flapping like some gigantic bird. "Who's the man?" She laughed, a nervous bark. He looked ridiculous with his skinny limbs and caved-in chest, but also, in a flickering, intermittent way, like his old self. Tall. She had forgotten that, how tall he was. Tall and almost stately, with his long hooked nose and wide shoulder. The hospital light ringed his naked head like a crown. "Tall king," she said in a strange, dreamy voice. Immediately she saw that this was ridiculous, an absurd non sequitur. He stopped and looked at her mockingly. "What did you say?" It was him. It was her tall, funny husband, but it was him plundered, him eaten away. Where has he gone, she thought. "Where's my handsome young husband?" Grief burst open in her like a vein, for suddenly she saw he was being taken bit by bit. He was being taken, and he would not come back. "Did you say tall king?" he said, but she was already crying. He stepped over and pulled her up into him, and she buried her face in his chest. She cried crazily, choking and spitting, not caring. When her sobs slowed, he took her face in his hands and kissed her forehead. "Can we sit down?" he whispered. He was shaking. Her tears stopped abruptly, as though a valve had been turned. She wrapped her arm under his shoulders and took his weight for the few steps to the bed. He let go of her and sat heavily. Then he reached for her hand and pulled her down next to him. They leaned back against the raised mattress and turned their faces to the window. It was getting dark. The lights in the parking lot were coming on. She watched the sharp line of his nose, the familiar bow of his lips. Her lungs were heavy and sodden, but her mind was quiet, clear for the first time in a long while. She could feel the warm tangle of their life together, the days and weeks and years. He was alive in her the way her ribs were alive, and yet she would never know how it had been for him all those weeks alone in bed, how he had thought about what lay ahead while she was pretending. A car started up in the parking lot, then another and another. Shift change, she thought. People going home or out to dinner or who knew where, going back to their lives. She listened to the cars accelerate one by one, thin lines of sound, a descending into the darkness. Friday night, she said. Yep, he said. He squeezed her hand.
Oops, sorry.
I guess my turn. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah,
all right. Yeah, this is closer than my face. I'm just going to read the beginning of a story. I don't think I can get it all the way through, so I'll have to leave you guys hanging. But this is called The Comforter. When we first heard about the cold front, possibly the worst in a decade, we paid it no mind. It was rare, even in the outskirts of Havana, for temperatures to drop below 10 degrees Celsius. The previous winter, we had been thrown into a bit of a frenzy by a few pneumonia cases. Alessio, a 62-year-old schizophrenic who weighed a measly 100 pounds, had ended up in a critical condition before passing days later at a city hospital. The director praised our response. Because Alessio hadn't expired at our location, he said, the old man didn't go in our records as a fatality. Truth be told, it wouldn't have made a difference. Nutrition and overall health have been in decline for quite a while. The occasional dead were nothing to fuss over, especially when it came to the mostly forgotten patients in a mental institution. In situations like this, the staff was to shut all windows and doors, provide coats to those who didn't have one, and allocate at least one extra bed sheet to every patient. Since virtually every employee in our wing, from the administrators down to the cleaning ladies, had at one point or another stolen things, we knew there wouldn't be enough. Ours was the largest psychiatric hospital in the country, and the amount of supplies that came into the stockroom could only be described as minimal. My friend Donis was an assistant stock manager at the ward. His philosophy was, why give it to a bunch of poor nutjobs who are going to break it and crap all over it anyway? Let the people who keep this place from falling apart get a piece of the action. I wouldn't have put it the way Donis did, but I agree with his overall view. Being constantly surrounded by the clinically insane, with an ever-shrinking inventory and every man for himself attitude, rules and accountability were the last thing on anyone's mind. The managers and administrators of the institution were all involved in inside businesses. Donis helped get the stolen merchandise out to sell or trade. This was his way of providing for his wife and two children, one of whom, his 3-year-old Amparo, had been diagnosed with autism. 2 days before the front was to arrive, the weatherman on the radio forecasted partly cloudy skies and mild winds. A refreshing breeze blew in through the open doorways and across the halls of the complex. Toward the end of my shift, I went to check on Beba, my oldest patient. Beba hated winter, so every night after tucking the edges of the bedsheet under her body, I would close the wooden shutters of her window and ask if that was better. She would wiggle slightly in her cocoon, checking that she was properly covered, and smile with the ingenuous pleasure of a girl who's finally been given the stuffed animal she's been begging for. At one point, Beba had been the star patient in the facility. She spent 2 decades in a large room in a restricted access building we called the White Wing, because it always looked so clean and had been regularly renovated. Donis had delivered boxes there a couple times. He said that he had an indoor garden, small gym with brand new equipment, and all the patients had individual rooms with televisions. The White Wing was reserved for reputable foreigners and family members of important government bureaucrats and military personnel. This was not the official word, but we all knew it. Beba was one of a handful of everyday citizens who had been treated at the White Wing. For a while, she had been the premier stop for international health delegates who were being shown the top-notch care Cuba offered its people. She had the right look and background back then. She was black, with short hair on a perfectly round head and eyes that could disarm you. I had seen a few photographs, and she had undoubtedly been a striking woman. She had also been a clandestine fighter during the revolution and a decorated construction brigade supervisor afterwards. She had the medals and certificates on her record to prove it. Her story, the reason for her internment, was tragic enough to make the delegations pity her. Beba's husband, a white university professor, had left Beba for her sister. He had taken Beba's 6-year-old son, Angel, with him to Spain. Beba spent a year trying to get her son back, but her husband had falsified all kinds of papers with the right people. She never saw Angel again. When a neighbor found her one night with blood smeared on her nightgown and a dead dog, a knife jamming into its neck by her front door, Beba claimed that her husband had tried to kill her in her sleep. She shared with me that there had always been a fire inside of her. I never wanted to be a home wife, she said. I'm going to stand tidying up the house, doing laundry, cooking dinner. My husband hated it. He said I wasn't feminine enough. But what could I do? I grew up surrounded by white men who demanded that I show my ass, that I shake it for them like a Tropicana dancer. Beba's emaciated body at 70, her dark skin sticking in crumpled patches to her bones, bore no resemblance to the voluptuous curves of a showgirl. Despite never being able to rid herself of hallucinations, visions of her husband attacking her or of Angel walking away over and over, Beba was usually in good spirits and willing to talk. At the White Wing, she had even met Diego Maradona during one of his stays to battle his drug addiction. On a day when her mind was clear, Beba had told me about a framed photograph that hung above her headboard in which Maradona was kissing her forehead. She had no idea who he was, but she knew he was famous, and it thrilled her. Unfortunately, the picture had been misplaced the day Beba was moved to the regular wing. No doubt it had already made its way to a tourist's hands somewhere in old Havana. After her transfer, she was given her own room, and she was the first to receive supplies, gowns, slippers, towels, pillows. In time, however, the director decided to strip her of what he called her privileged position. She was allowed to keep her room, but she was otherwise treated like any other patient. As she got older and more demanding about her needs, she was assigned to new orderlies. For the past 5 months, Beba had been my responsibility. "Angel, I'm still cold," she grumbled now, staring at the ceiling. "I can feel it in my bones." I caressed her head. "You've got a thick bed cover, Beba, and you know my name is Eber. Angel is not here. My skin does nothing for me anymore." "I know," I said. "Hang in there, okay?" "I'm hungry. Didn't you have dinner?" "The soup was salty," she said. This was part of our routine. I went to the table in the room and picked up the croqueta sandwich I had brought with me. Then I sat by her bed. "Here," I said, offering her small, flattened pieces. She chewed slowly. In between labored swallows, she looked at me, flashing a toothless smile. "You're such a beautiful boy, Angel, tall and strong, such beautiful brown skin. You look nothing like your father." "Beba, you know my name is Eber," I repeated. "You keep calling me Angel, and they're going to increase your dose." She recoiled and made as if to weep. I gave her some water. "Do you like the food?" She nodded and closed her eyes. "I will see you in 2 days, okay?" I said, and turned off the lights. As I exited the room, I bumped into Donis. "I've been waiting for you," he said. Before I could reply, he added, "Follow me." I followed him to the hospital's largest dock room. He unlocked the door and pointed to the box in the back. "Comforters," he whispered. I looked at the box. One of its sides was mangled as if it had been kicked. "There's only a handful left," Donnie said. "The director and managers took the rest." "So you got me this job, and now you want me to lose it." "This was a donation," Donnie said. "We didn't register in our inventory." "Someone's going to suspect." "Eber, you've known me since we were kids. When have I gotten you in trouble?" "I'm not sure I need one." "What about your new girlfriend? What's her name?" "Yolanda. Yolanda. She's coming to see you tomorrow, right? What if she wants to spend the night? It's supposed to be cold this weekend. You'll both be warm come Saturday morning, and you'll have me to thank for it." I laughed and smacked his chest. "If I didn't know you, I'd say you were a complete asshole." "Trust me. Keep your lady cozy. Take the comforter before you leave." I cringed as if about to sneeze. The dusty closet was getting to me. "Okay," I said. "I will." I swung my arm over his shoulder and playfully yanked his neck. Donis and I had grown up in the same orphanage. Even as a child, he had the reputation of being a loudmouth. For many years, I avoided him to keep myself from getting in trouble by association. Once we left the home, I began to respect his attitude. Donis wasn't shy about lending a hand to those he thought deserved it, including friends from the orphanage. We started lifting weights and going to baseball games together. He got married and built a family. I went to nursing school. When I finished my studies and needed a job, he promised me without hesitation a nighttime position at the asylum. Within the week, he secured my employment as an orderly, and whenever I complained about not having enough food or money, he found a way to give me cash. "I'm doing better than you are," he would say, "so don't even think about paying me back." And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. That was beautiful. So my first question, and anyone can jump in. I'll have like questions for particular writers, just for my own selfish reasons. I really enjoyed reading your books. But as a writer, and I'm sure there, how many writers are in the audience today? Great, perfect. How many readers are in the audience? Lots of readers. So my first question, when did you discover you were a writer? So what age, at what moment in your life?
That's the hard one to start with.
Can you?
Oh, you go, go.
If this works, I think it sort of does. I feel like it was so organic, and like it started in elementary school, and then I feel like what really changed for me is the process of no longer taking writing for granted in a certain way, by which I mean it's such an immigrant advancement tool. That's the way I really looked at it that way, and I wrote these essays and I would get scholarships or I would try to enter contests so that I could win money so that I could buy books for school. And there were things that writing allowed me to get in that very direct way. I really enjoyed writing application essays, and I really could have had a side business if I'd been less ethical. I think there really is a real reckoning and a moment of humility when you sort of want something else from writing, and it's not exactly resilience of things with regard to things you've experienced, but in a very emotionally immediate sense, it's wanting to make literature and make art and have it both be holding something you feel intensely, but also evoking something from other people and letting them get a chance to feel something as well with you. So it's a form of communication, but also really honest expression. I feel like that didn't really start until after college, you know? Like where I didn't just take it for granted, like, oh, I need 100, okay, you know? So I think that's helpful for writers who are also, you know, emerging, because I feel like the industry kind of encourages people to still think of it like a cash machine or a slot machine, like a Vegas kind of slot machine. Like you just write this manuscript and you click this and you get $250,000 advance. There you go, you know. But that's not what it's actually about. And the more you remember that, I feel like the more success you have. You know, like when you really say, this is mine, this is only mine, and I'm writing this, and I'm writing what I want to write. So if that helps anybody.
Would anyone else like to answer, or we can move on? I have lots of questions. Okay, so my second question is, I'm curious to know about the process of constructing characters. And in each story in your books, the characters are just like, they're human, they're flawed, they're complicated, and the endings weren't typical happy endings. Like the decisions that your characters made, it's like, man, well, if they didn't make that choice, maybe this person would be alive. Or like, can you talk about, I'll ask you, Daria, about how your characters in your book, how did you formulate them in your stories? Is there a character that stands out where you were like, you know, you had a difficult time forming the character's personality or interaction with their setting or people in their world?
I think for me, you know, one thing I'll say about endings, I don't know what it says about me, but I don't like happy endings, so.
I can tell.
Yeah. I think in life you rarely get one, so I think that it's more about sort of drawing from a lot of different places. Some of these characters are drawn from real life. Some of them are drawn from family stories I've heard. Some of them are sort of born out of thin air. Maybe what came before was an image or something that I wanted to work with. But for me, the way that the character comes out is through the test that I try to put them through. I like to make it hard for them. I like to give them a lot of obstacles. I like them to I like to force them to contradict themselves. So by doing that, it forces them to have to act, to have to speak, to have to catch themselves in these situations where they have a moral conundrum. And I think a place like Cuba, it's sort of a very common thing. Even as a young kid, I remember having moral questions about what is right and wrong and why, because of the reality and the poverty and the government and all of that. So I think in terms of mapping that out, I like to map out my plot so that I have a lot of difficulties for the character. And out of that, in the process of writing, their personalities come out and sort of their decisions come out. And they become, to me, a little bit more layered and more nuanced. And I like to, again, not end in a place where they're completely happy or realized or they completely redeem themselves. I like to try to aim for a kind of a more complicated place. Because, again, I find, or at least my memory of growing up in Cuba, it's that it always feels complicated living there. So that's sort of the process for me, just having the plot in place to then, in the process of writing, letting the character become a more real person.
So what would you say comes first, the character, the plot, or the setting?
I mean, for me, the setting, I knew that I wanted to write a story set in contemporary Cuba, so that was already there. But for me, the way that I work, even if I have a character in mind or a person in mind, I like to map the story out before I sit down to write. And it doesn't mean that it's going to stay like that. I might change in the process of writing. I might end in a different place. I might change my mind halfway into the story. But I like to have a roadmap so that I can sort of push the character to have to do things and react to things and have things happen to them and they need to do things. Or maybe they did something and it has an unintended consequence. So those are the kinds of things that I try to work out so that it's easier for me to draft it and then just spend a lot of time making it better and working it out. So for me, even if character's there first, the plot actually sort of plays out first and then in revision and really spending time with it, the character becomes sort of more interesting to me. So that's just my process.
And my next question is for Shaya. Shaya, can you touch on what I really loved about your book is how prominent the Indian woman is and just how, in my experience of reading fiction or just books, like that hasn't been my experience just seeing Indian women being just women, not that they can't be women, but it just, yeah, I just love the complexities, the normalcy that you, like, yeah, I would like to know. I love my favorite story was Talinda. I'm thinking very much of the main character. Narika, what's her name?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about, was that intentional for you to ensure that the Indian woman was prominent in your book?
I think what's really fun about writing fiction is that it's really the opposite of the expository essay, right? Where you start with a thesis and then you try to make an argument and prove it. I feel like it just kind of evolves from your sensibility and what you yourself enjoy reading. So, but that said, you know, I really think, I think in my collection, it's really women of color more generally. You know, like in Talinda, it's both a South Asian or Indian woman, Narika, but Talinda, the title character, is Korean American. And, you know, there are lots of other dyads like that. Like in another one, A Shaker Chair, it's really a kind of relationship between an Indian woman and a Ugandan American woman, like a woman who's, you know, family emigrated under Idi Amin. And so I feel like there have been too many instances where women of color had to write explaining a lot of stuff, or like the italics, the glossary. And I'm very grateful to people who already did that so that now we can claim a different space where we can just write as our characters, just as people, and not with that explanation, you know? I think it's a more satisfying reading experience in the end. I mean, people might feel like, oh, what's this? And these are odd names or whatever it is. But I think it's worth taking that leap And I'm really excited that more and more writers of color are able to do that and be read.
Thank you. And which characters would you guys say was your, like, the most natural story to get on the page?
You got the list. You got the easy one.
We're coming for you.
I know. The most natural. Can I tell you the most difficult one? You want the most natural?
Yeah, let's talk about the most difficult.
The most difficult one was the little girl and the Someday Cat. I found her the most difficult. She's a little girl whose mother is kind of neglectful, and her siblings are being traded for things like washing machines and stuff. It's based on a real story, actually. And I just had such a hard time writing about such a vulnerable person. It was really difficult, actually, to be in her.
Thank you. I got the signal to open it up to the audience for questions.
Thank you all. That was really, really wonderful. I loved all those passages you read. So, Danielle, it sounds like for you, you're really working, when you construct a story, you're working first with plot. You're thinking of your plot first. And I'm just wondering, for the rest of you, Mandy and Chaya, are you working the same way when you're constructing your stories? Are you working more with an emotional core? Are you working more with voice, do you find? Or do you have a similar process, Danielle?
I feel like it shouldn't be a conscious choice. That, I mean, it can be if you sort of have an exercise in mind. Like, one of my favorite type of exercises in this old book by John Gardner, where he says, you know, like, describe a barn seen through the eyes of a man who lost his son in the war without mentioning the war, the son, or the man. You're sort of, what? You know, but that's kind of neat. You can give, I do really think that giving yourself interesting writing prompts is a really good way to just get yourself going, get words on the page, remember can have fun with it. But I think, I feel like stories have come to me either like a character starts talking and then you figure out where they are and what's happening to them, or a story doesn't leave your mind. Like, I remember in one of my stories, Neela Bhopal, I remember reading about children who didn't have stable places to live during the chemical disaster. And so it's this gas, it's this odorless gas that killed a lot of people, this leak by this US Texas-based company, Union Carbide. And I just remember reading about this child who was out there and blinded, you know, by this damaging gas. So sometimes something will really stay with you and you just start figuring out how would you tell the story if you were somehow inside it from some perspective. But I think those two things letting yourself hear a voice and not judging, will other people think this voice is interesting, and going by whether you think it's interesting, and then the other thing of imagining a scene and trying to figure out how would you look at it, like where are you looking at it from. I think those can be very useful. I've found them useful.
Yeah, I think in a similar way, something comes to me that's almost like a seed, like the beginning of a situation. There's a character and they're in some situation. For instance, with that story I was just talking about, I read an article about this family that was giving away their children. And so that was the situation. And then you bring something personal to it, right? And so I thought of the situation, and then the character came very quickly to me of this little girl who was a particular age. But a lot of it is already set. I ask myself questions, but that character was a complete character when she came to me. Do you know what I'm saying? And so I don't feel like I have a ton of control over it. It comes, and my job is to unpack it and see what's in there. If that makes sense.
Thank you. This is kind of personal. Often times I've read or heard artists say they never view their work, for example. So I'm curious, how would you describe it, either analytically or emotionally, when you read your work? What happens to you?
That's interesting.
All right, so your question. I mean, for me, it brings me back to the moments when I was working on it, when I was writing it, and I think, you know, it's sort of a reconnection with the work itself and the characters themselves. When enough time goes by, you start to not necessarily forget, but you don't think about them as often as you are when you're working on them, sort of closer to the work, and you're probably working on new things. So, for instance, many of these stories were written years ago. So it's an opportunity to sort of reconnect with those people because they, to me, are real. They're not, you know, they're not just characters in a book. These are people because I've spent so much time thinking about them, writing them, exploring them, asking questions. They are real to me. I mean, in my mind, many writers may feel that way. You know, it's beautiful because your world expands. You know, all these characters become part of your world and they become people you know. But it's a little bit crazy because they're not necessarily like literally out in the world. So for me, it's just an opportunity to say hey to like an old friend and remind myself what they did and you know, and just reading the beginning of the story, I'm thinking I need to read it, I need to finish it, you know, I need to read the rest, even though I know what happened. So I don't know, I enjoy the process again of reconnecting. I have to say, like I always tell my students, like if you don't like your own work, you're not gonna write. Like, and I spend enough time with them because I'm obsessed with these people. Otherwise, I wouldn't write about them. So, you know, the writing, it's another thing. I always edit and re-edit every time I read, and I'm like, that could have been better. But in terms of the characters, it's an opportunity to really reconnect with like an important part of my life. So I do enjoy reading from work, especially if I haven't read from that for a while.
It's interesting, you all wrote or read stories this morning covered dancing around death and loss. And it kind of makes me wonder, your collections there of short stories, do you have certain themes that lace them together, or how do you choose what you put in the book of your short stories?
I think there are themes. I mean, just very practically speaking, the choosing in part for me was done by an editor who said, I think these go together and these ones don't fit. Do you know what I'm saying? There are themes in mine. I think I used to have a joke with a friend that the title should be Death, Despair, and Other Things You Don't Want to Read About, but it's not really that dark. But loss is a theme, I think. But also, in this book, I think somebody described it on 20 Stories. They described it as a bunch of desperate characters, and I think there is some truth to that. Each story is somebody at a kind of a crisis point. But that said, it's not all dark and gloom. Does that answer?
Yeah. I feel like the theme of revenge is very prominent in my story collection. I'm quite proud of that. But, I mean, I think it's a different... I mean, in some cases, like in Talinda, A Shaker Chair, in some ways, you know, many of the stories, like somebody gets it. Like somebody gets what's in some way coming to them. Or, you know, like if you've seen the musical Chicago where all these women sing, he had it coming, you know, like, you know, I think the other nuance of revenge is when some tragedy happens or something has happened in your life, like in the story The Goddess of Beauty Goes Bowling about a father and a daughter, but there's really no one to blame and there's no way to avenge the sense of something having been taken from you, and I'm really interested in what people do then, you know? So, but I would say revenge is a good place to start. Mm-hmm.
We have 12 minutes. We still have, I think we have time for one more question before we close out.
Okay. Are there any books on writing that influenced you or that you would recommend to aspiring writers? Any books on the writing process?
Don't look at me. I'm the worst person to ask. It's funny because I work with writing teachers. I am not a craft book person. I've read a few and I found some of that helpful. But I kind of came into writing the old-fashioned way, just reading and trying and failing and imitating. So even though I do use it when I teach, because I know that some students and writers find it useful. I wouldn't be able to recommend anyone particularly or an entire book, to be honest with you, just because I don't sit down and write and think, what's the definition of plot? You know, that's not how, like, it doesn't work that way for me. So I have my own process. I've developed it over a few years. And then I just trust that process, and I trust the freedom, and I trust the messiness, and I go with that. But what I am constantly doing is constantly reading, constantly consuming art, constantly stealing from other artists who are better than I am, and using that in my work. And that is sort of my craft process. It's sort of a more organic, sort of consume work, take what I can use, expand my toolbox. But I don't go too often, because I find that language and that way of expressing or talking about writing, just the way my brain works, just it's not as useful. I don't need definitions. I don't need, you know, particular neat ways of understanding something to make it work. So I am not a good person to ask that question to.
I wanted to say, I think more helpful than books. There are books that are great. There's so many of them. I mean, you can go look. But more helpful, I think, is to take a class and be with other people, because just the process of having people reflect back to you how they experienced what you wrote is actually more educational and more inspiring than anything you could read. You know, you need that two-way street, is what I would say.
I think the real-time interaction is a lot of fun, and classes can be very helpful, but I was thinking, I'm lucky because I was the last one to answer the question, so I had time to come up with a list, so I have a list for you. And I really think the type of craft book that's fun to read is more like a memoir by a writer who intersperses tales about his or her life, or their life, with sort of some amount of guidance. So the names that I would really encourage you to check out, Alexander Chi, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel. It sounds like a manual, and it's completely not. It's a book of beautiful essays about different points in his own life, but there's plenty of craft advice sort of packed in there. On Writing by Stephen King, which is framed as a memoir about him in general, but really it's all about the writing life that leads up to this terrible accident he had when he was hit by a van or something in New Hampshire, and you know, just how he rebuilt himself as a writer to even finish that book after the accident. So that's really wonderful. And then I would read Making a Writing Life by Caroline C., S-E-E. She's terrific. Unfortunately, she's gone now. Her daughters are still alive and writing. So it's like a biracial Chinese, Caucasian family. Caroline C. kind of writes about all these different adventures and marriages and unfortunate things she said when she was drunk at a party. It's very funny. It's extremely funny. But it gives you a lot of tools about not only writing, but sending out your stuff and developing relationships. And I definitely think writing community, if you can't have it because of your day job, the books can be a substitute, you know, at least for a while. And then I guess the only other name that I would mention, and you can read anything by her, is Anne Lamott, L-A-M-O-T-T. Bird by Bird is really good, and she's just very kind. She's really, really kind person writing about writing. So I would start there if you're looking for books. Welcome.
One last question, then we'll wrap up.
Thank you for reading your stories. I wanted to ask you guys about the writing like to like structure your writing during a certain time or part of the day? Like, what goes into the creative process for each of you?
I mean, these days I'm trying to write whenever I have time for it. I have a lot of different things going on. But I will say that for me, what makes it easier is to obsess over a project. So if I have something, you know, whether it's working on a novel or an essay or a short story, if I have something that's really calling me, I will find my week-to-week schedule sort of for that writing process. I'll make it a priority. I'll insert it whatever I can and come back to it, think about it when I'm going to sleep, wake up thinking about it again. So I think having that level of obsession with a project and knowing that I want to get it somewhere better allows me to just make the logistics or, you know, the real sort of the reality of sitting down and writing much easier, because I will make excuses not to do it. I just need to. And in fact, it might interfere in other parts of my life where I might be too distracted to listen to a conversation because I'm thinking about the work that I need to get back to. And I do think that for me, that's when I realized I was going to be a writer. It's like, I can obsess over this. I can make it a priority. I'd rather be here than at the beach and just like finish this project. And so I think if you have that, it just makes it easier to work out the other parts of it. You know, I used to be a morning writer, but again, these days I just write whenever I can find the time.
When you have kids.
Yeah, exactly.
I still block out time the day before on my calendar to make sure that, because it would be so easy for me to do the things everybody else wants me to do, if you know what I mean. So when I worked full time, I got up at 4:30 and I wrote till, but now that I have kids, I'm too tired to do that. So I make a block of time, I make sure I get those hours in, and then I do what everybody else wants me to do later.
Yeah, I really like the mixed approach, too, in terms of, I think it's so good to have, like, Walter Mosley actually has a beautiful book, This Year You Write Your Novel. I recommend it. It's very slim, and he says, you will not get anywhere unless you give yourself an hour and a half a day, you know, and he, like, analyzes. He's like, 20 minutes, too little. 4 hours, if you have a full-time job, maybe you can't do it, you know, like, but he gets it down, you know, and I think there is some grain of truth in that, because I do find if you at least make it to an hour, you feel better when you stop for the day. You don't feel as dissatisfied. But in writing the story collection, maybe more stories than novels can go this way, I started to make use of interstitial time. Like, one of the stories is written at my 7-year-old's ballet class. Like, every time I would be, you know, sitting there and you know, waiting in cars for people. I mean, just, you know, when they're watching TV, you're in the background doing something. I really have a healthy respect for interstitial time, because you can make it work for you, you know? And not everyone can sort of fetishize this 3-hour block of time when you lock the door and you know, that's nice, but you can find other time.
Thank you so much, everyone, for your time. Thank you, Dario. Thank you, Mandoline. Thank you, Shia.
Thank you.
There's going to be an author talk following this session, so if you want to head downstairs and if you have your books, you can get them signed, or if you want to purchase them, I highly recommend that you purchase all of the books. They're amazing reads. Thank you.